My name is Gary Deuce-Babick. I work for Rackspace, just to tell you a little bit about me. This presentation, it can be technical or it could not be technical, depending on what the audience is like. So just by show of hands, how many people here would say you're highly technical? Awesome. How many people here are just trying to be informed? Cool. Okay. There'll be a little bit of something for everybody, but I just wanted to make sure that this was a technical or non-technical group, just so that I could talk at the right level. We'll be having a question period at the end, and we'll proceed that way. Just so that I can be fully transparent with all of you, I work on Apache Cassandra, which is one of the NoSQL database solutions. I'm a committer for the project. I work on the project management committee. So, of course, I'm a little bit biased as far as what is the most awesomest NoSQL database, but I've done my best today to try and remain neutral, to present everything fairly, and don't be afraid to call me out at the end if you think I haven't. I'm open to being corrected or adjusted. My goals for you is, a lot of you probably are asking questions, wanting to know more about NoSQL databases, what's out there. You're going to be asking questions like, hopefully you'll walk away from this with some answers. In fact, should I be using NoSQL databases in the first place? Should I be sticking with relational databases? Okay, so I've determined that I need to try something different. How should I go about it? And then hopefully I'll give you some cautionary warnings, things to watch out for, some pitfalls hopefully that you can avoid. To start off, we're just going to take a look at history. The history of databases, it all started back, well, that's too far back. We should go forward a little bit to the 1960s, where we had these brand new things, these disk drives that were replacing magnetic tape. The problem with magnetic tape, of course, is that you have to seek. It's a very expensive operation to find your data. You've got to roll tape, go forward and backward. And magnetic disks and disk drives in general arrived on the scene, and you had, for the first time, almost direct access to your data, your durable stored data. So there was no longer such a penalty for seeking for data. And what this did is this enabled all kinds of new possibilities for applications that you could build, things that you could do with computers. And of course, we saw the first generation of databases, which were what we would call navigational databases. And there were two kinds of those. There were hierarchical databases, where basically you would follow links and traverse them hierarchically. It's pretty self-explanatory. There was no such thing as a key. That concept hadn't been thought of yet. This was just data on a disk, and you've basically followed pointers from piece of data to piece of data. There was also the network database, which is basically the same kind, only you had pointers going in all different directions. These are pretty primitive, but you can imagine the industry was just new. It was just getting started. People were starting to think about things. In the 1970s, the situation changed a little bit. A computer science professor by the name of Edgar Codd came up with a relational model. A lot of you have probably seen the paper. It's still cited quite regularly, and it's still cited quite regularly in the papers that you see coming out these days. He proposed a relational model of data storage, and this became really dominant, and it's dominant through the 90s. It's dominant now. And what the relational model did was it emphasized search over navigation. So you were able to start thinking about your data in whole different ways. This was good for querying things because you could find things quickly. You didn't have to know where your data was ahead of times. Of course, indexes were still possible with the older hierarchical databases, but these relational concepts made it different. Of course, relational databases, or the concept of having a relational database, still had problems. It introduced heavy demands on processors. And the way that it modeled relationships was kind of backwards. The relationships in a relational model aren't explicit. We have these foreign keys that are kind of tacked on to point to where other data that is related to your primary data is. The entity relation models that came along later in the 70s helped out with this quite a bit. Of course, it just put a conceptual model on top of these relational paradigms. And this has served the industry really well. A lot of us, you know, those of you in the audience who come from a computer science background, that's one of the things that they pound into computer science students in their first year usually, is thinking in terms of relational algebra. These are my projections, these are joins, things like that. And so this is something that a lot of us, myself included, it's hard for us to get this kind of thinking out of our heads. It's to the point where it's basically the way we grew up thinking about data is in relational concepts. And so when we start thinking or seeing ideas that are outside of that, they seem foreign to us, they seem really strange. This brings us to today, where our data needs have changed. Or have they changed? At Rackspace, we run servers there, and one of the things that they've grappled with for years was what to do with NetFlow data that comes from routers and from switches. And there's all kinds of interesting things that could be done with this data, from the level of billing, from the level of threat detection, and things like this. But for years, the technology just wasn't there to do anything really useful with it. And so Rackspace as a company was limited by that. They had all this data, but the technology wasn't present to do anything useful with it. Fast forward this to today, the last 3 or 4 years, the technology really has changed. It's enabling us to do useful things with this data. I would probably trace it back to when we started seeing papers about the Google file system in 2003, Bigtable in 2004. That's when a lot of this research, we were starting to see it in production, and people picked it up, carried it, ran with it, and we have this nice ecosystem today. So you've reached this point to where you decide, well, maybe I need to start thinking about choosing a different database system. And the first question you really need to ask yourself is, well, should I be doing this? What's motivating me? I think there's a temptation among technologists to I guess, for lack of better words, grab the new hotness. And NoSQL has grabbed quite a bit of that in the last couple years, to the point where I think that some people might be examining it and looking at it for the wrong reason. Maybe some interesting new startup makes a blog post saying, yeah, we're using HBase or we're using Cassandra, and it's awesome, and it's solved all of our problems, and yay. Stop, slow down, think about things, and ask yourself some questions. Recognize at the same time that choosing technology is still really hard work. There's a lot of bad roads you could go down, and you usually end up taking a couple of those paths, and that's good. Getting there, it's a process. You'll make bad decisions, and good ones hopefully at the end. So the first question you should ask is, well, can I still solve this problem with the relational database? Can I do it? And the answer to that, I guess it relates around a few things. Is your database falling apart? Are you having problems issuing alter table statements that take forever to do? Are you finding that you're having problems with indexes keeping up with your tables? Do you have too much data? You basically need to figure out what you need. So a couple of the ways that relational databases fall apart is in two general areas. We have scaling and we have availability. Scaling, there's a couple different aspects of it, but generally your monolithic relational database generally sits on one machine, and it's one process, and so that represents a single point of failure. There's different ways that's dealt with using master slaves, and we'll talk about that. But generally, relational databases, they suffer from that problem. And the ways that you address this is, well, I'm going to go ahead and shard my data, or I'm going to denormalize my data, at which point, in effect, you're really already utilizing a NoSQL solution. Lots of companies and organizations do this with traditional relational databases. They just shard things to the point where their foreign key constraints no longer make sense. Their index, they get away with indexes and roll their own. And so, I mean, that's one way of scaling your relational database. Another problem with scaling of relational databases is that the scaling isn't linear with respect to cost. And when I say that, what I'm talking about is if you want to get a database that has twice as much storage or twice as much computing power, it's not going to cost you twice as much. It might cost you four times as much. It might cost you 10 times as much. And so, you know, that's one thing to think about when you're considering scaling. As far as availability, I kind of already covered that when I talked about scaling. Relational databases typically make themselves more available by having master and slaves. You'll see master. There's certain problems with those related to how the consistency of your data is maintained. We'll talk about that in a little bit. So, what do you need? Maybe you're trying to reduce costs. Maybe you're trying to increase the throughput of your system. This is both reading and writing. Maybe you're trying to increase the availability of your system. You want to run a system in multiple data centers and have reads service locally, always depending on where the request for the read comes from, things like that. You also need to think about the recoverability of your system. Different NoSQL databases have different recoverability stories. Some are better than others, of course. You also need to think about correctness. When I say correctness, that is, if I make two queries at the same time and then they're the exact same query, well, I expect to have the same result. I don't expect to see the wrong result coming back in one of those queries. How you can cope with transactions. You know, a lot of people, when they're first being exposed to these non-relational or NoSQL concepts, say to themselves, I must have transactions. And in reality, when you look at what you really need in your application, it's just something that you've gotten used to over the years from working with regular databases. Transactions should be a means of last resort always, because transactions mean locking, and locking means things get slowed down quite a bit. And so transactions are one of those things that the NoSQL databases play fast and loose with. They define the where their transactions happen. They're all pretty have atomicity at some level, but where they define where those atomic operations happen is different among the databases. Another thing you may need or may not need is the ability to have a flexible schema. With a relational database, your tables are defined up front, which means you have all of the columns. You specify that when you issue your DDL. And what happens when you come along, you know, 6 months, a year later, and you want to add a column to your database? You issue an alter table statement. Well, what happens when you need to issue an alter table statement when you have this huge master with 15, 20, 35, 40, 50 slave processes, you know, listening to it? Things get locked up and things slow down quite a bit. I was talking, I don't remember how long ago, to one of the MySQL DBAs at Twitter, and they were telling us some of the problems that they were having with MySQL as far as altering their schema. And I forget the time period, but it was in the level of hours how long it took them to issue alter schema on their database. And so those problems exist. Okay, so one of the problems with NoSQL is that it's a really crappy definition of a set of technologies. And to illustrate that, I just put up a couple pictures here. These are all things that fly. You know, we could classify them as flight, but then if we wanted to go ahead and classify everything that doesn't fly, that leaves us open to a lot of different things that aren't necessarily related. You can do different things with. And so NoSQL is really just, it's a bad term for describing technology. All it means is this doesn't use SQL. And in some cases, some of them do, but they're still called NoSQL. So think about that. Just because technology gets the label of being NoSQL doesn't mean that it behaves the same as every other NoSQL data store. They're all, in fact, quite a bit different from each other. So, some considerations that you need to make. You need to think about what you're going to accept for fault tolerance. This means the way that the system, the NoSQL system, is going to handle a server crashing, a hard drive failing, the network getting partitioned. They all handle things in a little bit different way depending on what their distribution model is like. You want to think about how they handle recovery. When you bring up another, when you restart a process, is it going to take a long time for it to get things back in the state that you want it to be in? You need to think about the replication model. There's basically two different kinds of replication models. There's a fully distributed, and then there's master-slave, which you know you see in relational databases as well. You want to think about how you're going to access your data. This means how are my programmers going to make queries? How are they going to connect to it? Are there language drivers and things like that that we're going to be using or that are even available? A lot of these systems are open source systems, and their support like that is kind of limited unless there's commercial backers helping out. Hooks. In relational databases, you have triggers, you have stored procedures, things like that. Some of the NoSQL systems have similar kinds of mechanisms, some don't. So think about whether your application is going to require that or not. And also, I covered this already, think about the distribution model. Something else is to think about is the data model. There is, an impedance mismatch that I talked about already. When you're used to thinking in things in relational terms, some of these databases, these NoSQL databases, model data quite differently. We'll talk about some that use just a document model, some that are basically simple key value stores. This requires you to take a look at your application. In some cases, you're going to have to change the way that you model your data, the ways that you access your data. Same thing goes for the way that you query your for your information. We're all used to being able to issue a select statement where we add a bunch of parameters restricting, you know, focusing in on the exact data that we need. Well, with these systems, you lose a lot of that. For the most part, they're largely just key value stores, and so all you get is that one way to query. Some of them support secondary indexes that have different, computational costs associated with them. Sometimes they're just hard to maintain. But you want to try and model your data in a way that you can get what you want with just a single key. That's where you're going to see the best performance out of the systems. The transactional semantics of all of these NoSQL databases are quite different. In relational databases, we're used to hearing terms like ACID compliance. And the level of atomicity for every NoSQL database is going to be quite different. That's just something to think about. You'll also want to think about read versus write throughput. So some applications are just naturally heavy write-intensive applications. Some examples of this would be time series databases, where you're constantly getting information from sensors or from web servers or whatever, and you're constantly writing, and the only time you want to do a read is where you want to make a graph or do something like that. Other systems are very read intensive. These are your search engines would be a good example of that, where people are constantly querying it. The different solutions have different benefits as far as whether they're better for read-intensive or write-intensive, or whether there's tunables that you can adjust to make them ideal for you. Something else you'll want to think about is how you deploy and manage these systems. A lot of these systems are open source, and a few of the open source ones have commercial companies that have come in. They do several things. They help with development, and they also offer solutions as far as supporting you in case you want to bring your team up to speed. You want them to learn how to manage the databases. Some don't have that, and so you're kind of on your own. It depends on what you want for your organization, how much work you're willing to do on your own. So I'm going to talk about these five ones right here. Up on the upper right there are Mongo and Redis, and those are distributed in a master-slave fashion. And on the bottom left there are three that I would consider fully distributed. which means they've taken the shared nothing architecture, where every node in their cluster is the same. We'll start off talking about Mongo. Okay, Mongo is a document-oriented database. Basically, you have a key for your data, and the value is going to be a JSON blob, which you put multiple key values in, or however richly you want to define it. And that's a good aspect, because it basically gives you a naturally denormalized feel out of the box, and it gives you a very, very flexible schema. If time goes on and you decide you want to start storing different data in it, you can do that. It's not going to affect all of the data that you've written before. It's not going to alter how much space is used by that data. It's not going to take you a long time because there's no DDL that needs to be issued. And so those are some things that are naturally good about Mongo. Something else is that Mongo is pretty programmer friendly. It is one of the fastest database systems I've seen that you are able to go from download to actually programming queries on, and it's a matter of minutes. They've optimized for this, and they've made it easy. And because of that, I think that's one of the reasons that it's actually gained a lot of popularity, is that it's quite easy for programmers to get access to. One of the other things is that Mongo has quite a bit of language drivers. So no matter what your application is written in, chances are good that there's going to be something native for you to be able to access it in and use it for. Mongo's atomicity level is that writes are atomic on a single document, which is basically the value that you're storing. You don't have I think of them as rows in my mind. But you're atomic down to a single document. On the other hand, Mongo isn't going to be good for a real-time big data analytical warehouse type application. This is because the data model is pretty rich. Now, you could make it work by making your documents really small, at which point you've lost the benefit of having that rich data model. But typically, people use Mongo because they have these documents that they want to store. When you read your documents back, you're getting the whole document. You can't. You can filter it out, but that filtering doesn't happen at the server level. It happens a little bit later on. So you're paying the penalty for throwing the extra data away. One of the other deficiencies of Mongo is that compaction is kind of blocking. I haven't followed this too closely recently to see how they've addressed this. But I know that it's something that the developers have been working on, and I'm sure it'll have a good solution. But as of right now, compaction is a blocking operation for Mongo. The queries kind of get complicated, and I'm sure that it just feels this way until you get used to it. Here's an example of some queries in Mongo. It's a JSON notation for finding your data. This one here, find me all foo objects where j is not equal to 3 and the k attribute is greater than 10. And the same thing down here, find me all foo attributes where the name is Bob or a equals 1 or b equals 2. If you're used to having a nice pretty query language, you're in for a little bit of a learning curve when you switch to something like this. This kind of approach makes it really hard to do like search and replace when you're wanting to update queries and things like that. Mongo uses master-slave replication, and this is neither a good thing nor a bad thing, but it's just something that you need to be aware of so that you can approach it from the right way. The replication is asynchronous, and so this means you get failover and you get data redundancy, but at the expense of a little bit of consistency. And so the master and slave works this way. You can always write to the master, and you can read from the master or the slave. And so, hypothetically, there is a window of time where you issue a read statement that one goes to the master and one goes to a slave. You have the possibility of getting different data back. And if you can deal with that and your application can survive and that's not a problem, then good. Otherwise, you might want to look at doing something else or using something different. But like I said, atomic writes are good and easy. Redis is another master-slave database. I like to think of it as a memcache for sets and lists. It's really good at real-time stats tracking. So these are situations where your data is changing constantly, and it handles fast-changing data very, very well. You get, like I said, collections, sets and lists built in. On the other hand, it is an in-memory database, and I suppose that's neither a good thing or a bad thing. It's just something you need to be aware of. They have this way of snapshotting data. If you're worried about durability, they have a way of snapshotting data where your data gets persisted to disk. But realize at the same time, any updates that you've made to your main data store after your snapshot has been persisted are you know at peril. If your system was to go down, lose a server, or whatever, there's that delta where information can be lost. Redis also supports master-slave, and it works the same way. Replication is asynchronous. You can read from masters or slaves, but you of course can always only write to the master. And probably the biggest limitation is that you're essentially RAM limited. I mean, you're not really RAM limited because you can have this offline or this off-memory storage, but Redis is really designed to perform if your data set fits in memory, and when it does, it's a really good solution for that. Another one is React. Now, I've branched into the fully distributed data stores. These are ones that do not use master-slave replication. They typically take what we call a shared nothing approach, meaning that every server in the cluster is going to be basically the same. There's no master or controller or anything like that. Some things that you get for free with React is the concept of having relations. These are links that point from one record type to another and make it easy to, I guess, group your data together. Something else you get is built-in MapReduce. And that's not to be confused with built-in Hadoop integration. What they do is they just offer you a framework for doing MapReduce jobs within their database system. React is completely schemaless, which means you don't have to tell it anything about your data. I think they call them keys in buckets, which is just it's another key value store. Every one of these databases calls their data something different, and in React, they call them buckets. But you can put whatever in your buckets, it doesn't matter. The nice thing about React is there is no single point of failure. In the other systems where there's master-slave, if your master goes out, well, you've got your slave to service reads, but you're up the creek as far as serving writes. With these fully distributed systems, you don't have that weakness. Of course, they have another set of weaknesses, but you don't have to worry about single points of failure. Nicely, an attribute of React is that it scales linearly. They divide their data space up into 64 into... I'll get to that point in a little bit. I was skipping ahead of myself. You also have tunable consistency. This basically means that in a distributed system like this, your data is going to be copied, replicated to multiple servers. A highly consistent system means that there is very little delta or very little possibility of you issuing a write and making a read where you get the old value back before it's made to all the replicas. They've made that so that it's tunable, so that you can have faster writes or slower writes depending on how consistent you want your data to be or how comfortable you are with maybe the possibility of getting the wrong read back after making a write. A neat thing about React is they have this concept of pre and post hooks. These are kind of like pre and post triggers on their system, and that's kind of cool because it allows you to be empowered to take a little bit of the control of the data in your hands, not just from your application, but just it puts the work really close to the server, where it can be done a lot more quickly. another interesting aspect of React is that it has configurable storage engines. There may be more than three, but the three that I'm familiar with is Bitcask. This system works well when all of your keys fit into memory. It's just one of the ways that Bitcask works. And there's also InnoDB, which is probably the one you want to use. They have different performance metrics that I'm not going to get into here. But InnoDB, if all of your keys don't fit in memory, that's the one you definitely want to go to. And of course, there is a memory-only storage engine, which basically makes React look like a big, giant, distributed memcache. And that's pretty cool. One thing that React makes pretty easy is by giving you REST access. And a lot of people discount this in their systems until you start talking to programmers who are the ones who are actually trying to interface with these databases. REST makes accessing data pretty easy. Being a programmer myself, I can vouch for this. Other systems have complicated native drivers, or maybe they use Thrift or something like that. It becomes a real pain in the neck trying to program against these sometimes clunky interfaces. Something else React has is really easy cluster balancing. Their entire data space is divided up into 64 pieces, and no matter how many nodes you have in your cluster, they each get a 64th bit, or a 64th of the data. It's spread around evenly, so that when you introduce a new server or servers to the clusters, they get data from all of the other servers in the cluster, rather than just from a specific set. And so what this means is you're not going to have hotspots when you're adding new servers into your cluster. Some other systems, they don't have this capability. So that's something to think about if you're considering a system where you're going to start off with a small cluster and it's going to be under load and you're going to want to upgrade it soon or in the near future to add more servers. One aspect of React is it doesn't naturally keep data sorted. You're basically just putting things in and getting things out. So it's a key value store. And Erlang, this is neither a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a programming language that doesn't have a lot of use, which makes it fairly inaccessible as far as troubleshooting bugs, doing things like that. So if you want to invest in React, you might want to just invest in getting familiar with Erlang and its concepts and how to program it so that you can be better at troubleshooting some of your problems. Cassandra. Cassandra is kind of cool because it has a query language that it's been getting worked on for about a year now. And it's called CQL, and it tries to be like SQL as much as it can. And so this is kind of cool because it is familiar to people. You can run into problems by making bad queries that don't perform well, but you have that same kind of chance when you're using a relational database. Cassandra implements the distribution model of the Dynamo database, which is comes from Amazon, with the column store format that you see from Google's Bigtable, and it puts them together. Some interesting things that you get are range queries. There's two levels of range queries. One I think is cooler than the other. There's range queries among your keys, which you get if you make certain configuration settings. There's a weak side to having those kinds of key range queries in that inserts that have the same key or similar keys will go into the same nodes in your cluster. And so it is prone to hotspots. But most people who use Cassandra aren't really that interested in key range queries. They're more interested in row range queries, which in Cassandra parlance is called a slice. Cassandra is very good at that. It keeps the data sorted internally so that these slice queries, where you specify a start column and an end column, happen very quickly. Something else about Cassandra is it's data center aware. When you set up Cassandra, you specify which range of keys each node is going to be responsible for, and then you can organize the cluster so that all reads are going to be serviced locally, either from a rack or from a particular data center, and you're not incurring the round-tripping expense of making queries out to other data centers or other server racks, and that gives you a unit of performance advantage. Cassandra, over the last year and a half, has rolled out quite a bit of really good Hadoop support. DataStax is one of the companies that's providing a lot of the development and support for this, and they've gone a long way, come a long way. Another neat aspect of Cassandra is that you have really configurable caching. You have the ability to cache all of your row keys, which reduces the need to do scanning for where data might be. And you also have the ability to cache entire rows, which means that it effectively becomes a really fast memcache type of thing. Another thing with Cassandra, we'll call this a good one, but it might be a bad one, is that you get live schema changes. On the bad side is that you have to have some schema kept in Cassandra. Like I said before, Cassandra keeps its data sorted, so it needs to know what kind of data it is keeping sorted. Is this data a timestamp? Is it a time UUID? Is it a date? Is it something else? It needs to know about this information so that it can keep it sorted, and you have to specify that. But on the plus side, you get to change it on the fly if you need to either add schema, remove schema, or modify existing information. Then you can do that on the fly. Some other problems that Cassandra suffers from is that growing the cluster isn't fair. In React, this was a lot less of a painless problem because it pulled data from all nodes equally. In Cassandra, this isn't the case. When you introduce a new node to the cluster, you basically say, this is the point you're going to live at, and data is then pulled from neighbors. So you can introduce a hotspot into a certain region of your cluster, and Cassandra has historically not supported that very well. I think it continues to be one of the weaker aspects, one of the weaker spots of Cassandra. So that's Cassandra. A little bit about HBase. HBase has coprocessors. There are two variants of coprocessors in HBase. There are trigger-style coprocessors, and there are stored procedure type coprocessors. HBase is written in Java. You have the ability to write your coprocessors, at least the stored procedure types, in Java. And so something to think about if you're a Java-centric group, then HBase allows you to do a little bit of your work in Java. Another neat aspect of HBase is that you have version cells, and this comes from its big table lineage. This allows you the ability to query your data as it existed at a certain point in time, and that's useful for quite a few use cases. One other neat thing about HBase is it has very good, very tight Hadoop integration. HBase itself sits on top of Hadoop. Okay, one of the negative aspects of HBase is that the Hadoop name node does become a single point of failure. People might, the proponents will tell you, no, this isn't a problem, but at the end of the day, all of the ways that it is mitigated, there still is the potential for it to be a problem, and so it's not a true shared nothing. There is that possibility of having problems with Hadoop. HBase, you do have to plan for downtime if you're going to make modifications to your schema. That is something you have to deal with, and which means it just implies that your schema is required up front, just like in Cassandra. I think that the load balancing story for adding new nodes to an HBase cluster is kind of complicated because it happens at two levels. There's the balancing that has to happen among the HBase region servers, and there's also the balancing that has to happen underneath to the Hadoop file system servers. And so it's real complicated. There's quite a bit of nuances there. I don't understand them very well. And so it's something that you'll want to invest a significant amount of time learning and understanding and putting some effort into. The bottom line is that there's no silver bullet in your NoSQL database ecosystem. The silver lining on that, though, is that this is a space where there is a significant amount of startup investment. There's a significant amount of developer mindset going to. We see a lot of research coming out of colleges about how we can improve these systems, how we can make better data systems. I was reading a blog post about a week and a half ago how Accel Partners and IA Ventures have each put in over $100 million, so $200 million total in their respective big data funds. And so there's a significant amount of work and money going into finding better solutions to these big data needs. That's the end of my presentation. I ended a little bit early, but thanks for being here. It's now time for questions, if there are any. I think we'll start a line over here by the microphone. Is that what we're supposed to use?
Hello. Yeah. So I have a question about query languages. So I think advantages of relational database is SQL itself, the language. It's a standardized query language. One, there is no vendor lock-in. So if I use my SQL, I want to move to somewhere else. Technically, I should be able to move easily. My application should still work maybe a little bit. There's some customized things for each vendor, but I still have SQL as a language. And writing SQL queries isn't that bad. People have been learning this, and 30 years of people have implemented this. And so there is a lot of optimizations in these query languages. So it seems that with a NoSQL database, you're locked in. I choose MongoDB, I'm locked in, my application writes these JSON queries. If I want to change another vendor, I'm pretty much fucked, right? Unless I have to change all my application code. And besides, there are no joins. Do you need them or not? So my question is, do you think there's going to be a need of a standardized NoSQL query language, or at least one for a document, the document NoSQL ones for the key value NoSQL ones that you were saying, like Cassandra has the CQL? So do you think that's going to happen?
So the question is, do I think there's going to be a need for a standardized query language for NoSQL data stores? I can see how that would benefit things quite a bit. As far as being need, yeah, I can see there being a need for something standardized as far as querying the languages. But what's going to be an even bigger challenge is think of the reasons people start using these databases, these NoSQL databases in the first place, is because they either need to address throughput concerns or data storage concerns. So they're going to have a lot of data. So I think a bigger problem than having standardized query languages is going to have tools to migrate from one database to another. I think that's a tougher problem. And I don't know of any good, there are no good existing solutions other than just, you know, manual work, rolling up your sleeves and migrating your data. I can see how having common query languages would help. To the point where I wonder how generic it would have to be to support all of the different key value stores. If there was a way to keep it simple as far as maybe having a way to tell when to use an index, when not to use an index, and then keeping it simple as far as just querying keys and values, you don't have complex wares or anything like that. I could see some value. Applications wouldn't have to change as much. The real work would still be in migrating your data from one system to another.
Yeah, well, kind of 30 years behind of what relational databases have been doing, because that's a solved problem for them. Quick question. So when do I need to start using a NoSQL database from the sense of how much data do I need to have for it to not scale anymore, and how much should be that throughput or network or usage or whatever?
That's a matter of taste and a matter of the capabilities of your database system. I've seen, especially from the Stack Overflow people, you know, they talk about how they've still managed to keep all their systems in a relational database. And look at that site. They've published their numbers as far as traffic. They're obviously doing something right with their relational databases. They know what they're doing. And so I think it's going to be different from organization to organization.
Thank you for the presentation. Quick question I have. Any reading you can recommend of like changing your mindset from a relational database to NoSQL, especially like when it comes to reporting? Because we have a nice project which you know, which fits really well into the concept of NoSQL. You know, we are manipulating documents. You know, most of the operations are single reads, but sometimes you come across reporting, and now it's now a whole different animal. Mm-hmm. Where, like, old relational database approaches are no longer applicable. You're using your document filters, which are not indexed. So, you know, anything you can recommend how to change the mindset?
One of the hardest parts of breaking out of thinking in SQL or relational terms is knowing when to denormalize your data. And when I say denormalizing data, that's answering the question, well, when do I start keeping my data in multiple places to give me quicker reads? And it usually boils down to that, determining when you want to have fast reads. There's certain kinds of queries that just aren't possible in these key value stores. And that's usually a good indication that you need to break out and start duplicating your data.
And can we think of MapReduce as the way to approach reporting?
MapReduce is a very good tool for doing reporting. It's yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi. First, nice challenge accepted on your laptop.
Thanks.
So here's my question, because I'm a procedural PHP guy, self-taught, mm-hmm. and what I've had the hardest time with NoSQL and understanding and trying to get comfortable with transitioning, if necessary, is how to switch how you store the data now to how you might do it in NoSQL, because I don't usually work in an object world. And so I figured maybe you had a quick example, and here's a really simple one. You have products, a UPC code, and you're tracking every hour, say, their price. And it's just going to be, because I have this problem with the site that my own with different data. You're tracking a very long history, right? Every 2 years, every hour, you have timestamps, and you're mm-hmm. tracking that. And you are going to pull that out data-wise to chart it in different time frames. So how, in the key-value situation of NoSQL, would you store that? Like, how would you mark that up to translate that so you can actually access it in a quick way?
So your specific use case, you want to be able to access product pricing history?
Yes, correct.
One interest, I'll speak to this from a Cassandra standpoint because that's the way I'm most familiar with,
okay.
is I would use some kind of, I would have a key, a row key, and that would be the product ID or something like that.
Okay.
And then I would have a series of columns, and I would add a new column each time the price changed, or if I'm just doing this day by day, I would take a snapshot of the price on that day. And so each snapshot would be a tuple where the column name would be the time, and the value would be the price on that day. And so when you query that out, you, of course, query by row, which is your primary key, and then a time slice. So I want to give me all the prices between February 1st and March 1st, and it all comes back to you that way. And an interesting aspect of Cassandra is that's mostly a single seek on disk, and you don't have to go searching around the platters.
That's very helpful. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Hello. So from a developer standpoint, if I'm going to take just a standard web application and it's already on a relational system and put it into some kind of NoSQL, let's say Cassandra, for example, what are some of the top challenges that I'm going to run into, maybe from performance perspective, or what are some of the top things that people
sure.
usually run into?
What are going to be some of the top problems of porting a relational application to a NoSQL or non-relational application? If your reads are really dependent on utilizing indexes, then you're going to have lots of problems because basically the way that indexes are implemented in relational databases is that they are another little database that get queried when you need to use them. When you break out, you're going to have to, in some cases, roll these indexes on your own. Some of the NoSQL solutions have ways of doing that, but they approach it from the same way. You specify this is going to be my index, and the performance, I would say, isn't nearly as good as it is in a relational database, simply for the fact that typically you're going out to multiple machines to gather data to make queries rather than just one machine that has all of its storage right there. So that's probably the biggest problem. Is dealing with indexes. Other problems you're going to see are, to some extent, language support, things like that. But I think the indexes are going to be your biggest pain point dealing with those.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm stepping in as a database mint here. So Oracle just recently announced this Oracle NoSQL appliance. And how do you see that affecting the market, because especially in terms of penetration to large businesses?
I think, so the question is, Oracle just released a NoSQL appliance, and I'll go ahead and add to that that Amazon just released a product too, DynamoDB. And I think a lot of the small NoSQL startups are shaking in their boots. These big players are going to come onto the scene, and people are going to feel comfortable spending their money with them. And you know, there's the potential for them to really take over the market, just in terms of pouring marketing money and also just the normal course of development, making really good products. And so I think they're going to shake it up quite a bit. It's going to make make this segment of databases grow pretty quickly. Hopefully, we'll see a lot of research come out of them too. That would be a great thing for them to share.
So you're positive on this?
Am I positive about this?
Yes.
I'm not positive. No. I mean, I do think that they are going to make a dent. Amazon specifically, just because they make it so easy to consume their services. I don't know how Oracle's going to do. I've never been involved with buying Oracle databases. I imagine that they've got pretty good salespeople and ways of making those things happen. But they'll probably do well. But I think DynamoDB will do pretty well too.
Hi, my name is Chris. In response to somebody who just asked a question before me, there's a technology called Elasticsearch.
Elasticsearch?
Which we've looked into a little bit, that provides a solution for real-time searching and indexing. So that might be a...
Thanks for sharing that. We're actually using that a little bit at work right now using Elasticsearch for log searching.
Yeah.
It's useful. We use Greylog, and I think they've got an Elasticsearch backend.
My question was, I'm relatively new to NoSQL, and we've been getting a little into CouchDB, and I was wondering how that fit into the categories you mentioned today, and if you had any quick pros or cons.
You know, CouchDB was another one of the ones I thought about talking about, but I didn't have the time to dig in and make a. I've had virtually very little experience with it. You know, I haven't had any exposure to it, and so that's one I really can't answer a lot of questions about. I'm sorry.
No problem. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. If you are planning, there's kind of this meme of web scale. I mean, I'm building this application, and it's going to be huge. It's going to be the next Facebook. So
I try to avoid using that word. These are web scale databases, everybody.
It's going to my project's going to be the next Facebook.
That's right.
I need to deal with this. At what point, when you are starting out on your project and you have 10 users and 5 of them are your developer and the other 3 are your family, do you start thinking about where I'm going to be? I mean, at what point do you start thinking about that now? Or, I mean, because you end up like, you know, Google, YouTube's still using Postgres on the back end. Mm-hmm. They haven't moved all the way over. Twitter, I think, is still...
I've never been in that position, but you know, I know those who have, and of course they do start out using a relational database, and I don't think there really is a good way to plan. I think you do want to realize that at some point you're going to have to migrate your data, and if you expect to do that before it gets too painful. It takes time to move terabytes of data or import it into new systems. So I would say, just based on how long you think it's going to take for you to import and export your data, and if you can survive that kind of downtime or unavailability, then
Is there a way, if you're planning on going on a cloud provider like EC2 or Rackspace, planning your system architecture ahead of time to go horizontal? I mean, what's a good way to think about this?
Yeah. Well, one good way to plan for the future is just start thinking about your data in terms of keys and values, and not necessarily complex queries with lots of indexing and things like that. Because all of these NoSQL solutions, or most of them, have secondary indexes tacked on after the fact. But the truth of the matter is, you have this index, and in some cases it's spread out over multiple computers, you're not going to get the same kind of performance. And so if you can structure your queries and your data access such that you are operating on keys and values and do this from the beginning, then it's going to be a lot easier to go from a relational database to a NoSQL database.
Would developing with like something like Memcache in mind, would that make sense because the key value concept there? Or
I could see the possibility of that.
Another question. UI tools. So, for example, for SQL, you have, I don't know, SQL Server has SQL Management, and you can download Aqua Data Studio. When are we going to, and when do you think, or are there already tools for like UIs to visualize these?
I really have no idea as far as data modeling tools. Part of the problem is because there's such a different representation of how data gets stored. I mean, we have document stores, we have key value stores. The way that indexes are done differently, it's going to vary. And so putting that into a picture, into tools that, you know, that make it easy for people to use and model those, they're either going to be very specialized to the point where you have to switch tools going from one database to another, or they're going to be very generic, at which point they come, you know.
But not only tools to visualize the model, but just actually to run the query and get my results.
I'm sorry?
Not only tools to visualize the model, but also to query and get the results and see it in a UI instead of me writing the code,
Yes, I think that's probably the next general step of evolution of these systems is to where they have query languages. I mean, that's something that Cassandra has added in the last year. I think that's the logical next step, is to make the data easier to get at.
Hi. what's the general thought about mixing technologies like relational database like MySQL and storing IDs from, like, say, Mongo or in a relational database and just mixing the two technologies together? Is that a bad idea, or is that a common use?
I don't think it's a bad idea at all. The question is it generally a bad idea to mix relational and non-relational technologies? No. If it's solving your application needs, then of course it's not a bad solution. If it's solving your application needs and it's going to help you into the future, I mean, go for it, I say.
He just asked my question.
Go for it.
It was exactly that. But I just wanted to answer one or two of the other guys' questions on how do you sort of think about modeling with NoSQL, and, you know, feel free to comment, obviously. But when you're doing like relational database modeling, you know, you end up doing a lot of domain modeling, and, you know, you end up with, you know, ideally, you know, denormalized data, and everything's, you know, a perfect model of your domain. While with NoSQL, what you should be doing is modeling your usage. So let's say you've got two completely different domain objects, but they're always represented in your application together. That's a perfect example of where you would put those two things together in a NoSQL database. And so, yeah, so the difference is, rather than modeling your domain, you model your usage. And that was the big thing for me, the aha moment.
That's a very good point. You think about your queries rather than thinking about your schema.
Yeah. So.
Thanks for bringing that up. Thanks, everybody. Oh, okay.
Why do you think databases like D3 that came around in the 60s and 70s failed, that started the NoSQL movement?
You know, what database specifically were you talking?
D3 or Cache or...
Cache. Go Mumps.
Yeah. Basically Mump-style databases.
I've actually used Cache, and I quite like it. I haven't used it in a good 3 or 4 years now, so I don't know how well they've solved the problem of having a distributed system. I know they had a pretty good master-slave story. But... these systems, they were the original key value stores when you think about it. That's all a Mumps database is underneath. I think the relational concepts came out. They had a fair amount of research behind them, and it made it pretty easy for people to model and query their data, where these other systems, I don't know. It's really hard to say. I couldn't put a good answer on why they didn't succeed.
Hello.
I'm sorry.
Never mind. I'll ask.
We're out of time.
Okay. Thank you.